The views and content expressed on the following program are provided solely for informational and entertainment purposes. They do not constitute legal advice. A podcast is not a substitute for retaining a competent, licensed attorney to advise you on your specific legal situation. How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the show. It is time for Break the Business, where we empower indie creators and have some fun along the way. I'm Ryan Carella, and it is a pleasure to have you here this week. Oh my goodness, do we have ourselves a program. Lots of fantastic stories to talk about. Really thought-provoking things. I'm looking at the show rundown this week, which is where I have our topics written out, and oh my God, we're tackling the big stuff today. We got the stupid little stuff too. We're going to talk more about the Madam Web trailer that I continue to be obsessed with, but we got some hard-hitting stories too that we're going to talk about, and boy, oh boy, did we just bring it in terms of guests this week. Joining us on the program this week, two really terrific industry executives, Gary Jones and Spiro Arcutis from Medi Music joining us. This platform is really, really cool. I have always been a really big fan, folks, of music as medicine. I am a huge advocate of the therapeutic aspects of music, the power of music to heal pain, to ease stress, to make it easier to go through traumatic and difficult medical events. I really believe in this stuff, and there's a lot of science behind it. And so I'm excited to get to talk to Gary Jones and Spiro Arcutis all about the stuff that Medi Music is doing in this space to create favorable outcomes for people who are in hospitals. Really, really important stuff. Excited for that in the next segment. Also excited to bring in our co-host this week. We always love chatting with Katie Zaccardi. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Ryan.
It is so good to see you. Katie, I got to bring you in on the Madam Web silliness. For the viewers and listeners out there, I promise this is the last week I'm going to talk about this Madam Web trailer. But I continue to be obsessed with it. And you know I can't talk about something involving pop culture, especially like with like the cool young teenage stuff, without bringing Katie Zaccardi into that conversation. Her voice is too important to be left out. I want to tell you, Katie, about the silliness that we got involved with last week.
Okay.
So first thing I want to do, ask you, how familiar are you with the movie Madam Web and the completely unhinged Madam Web trailer that was all over TikTok a couple weeks ago?
So I'm basically familiar with like the lore. I haven't seen the movie, but I've heard a lot about how bad it is and that it's, I think it's just kind of like camp at this point. So I know enough, but not all of it, you know?
Camp, I think, is a good way of describing it. Elisa Rockdoc, who was the co-host last week, said she thinks that Madam Web has now reached a point in our filmmaking zeitgeist that it's going to eventually become one of those kind of movies that people watch at midnight showings every year in the East Village, and you shout things at the screen like Rocky Horror Picture Show or the room or something like that.
Yeah.
Elisa thinks it's...
I did not.
Like, oh, hi, yeah, Mark.
Like, oh, hi, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's giving that. Like, I feel like, especially in the way I've seen people talk about it, not only the script, not only the story, but also just the acting, the line delivery, like literally everything about it is camp. It's just camp.
Well, and you don't even have to get as far as actually buying a ticket to watch the movie to enjoy how insane this film is, because the trailer itself gives you enough to enjoy. And TikTok had a field day just breaking down some of the craziest parts of the trailer. And I think the part of the trailer that's gotten most people laughing and just joining together in one singular moment of just thinking how crazy this is has been the line about halfway through the trailer where the main character played by Dakota Johnson is talking about the main antagonist to the movie, Ezekiel Sims, and she utters a sentence that is just so disconnected from any sentence that any actual human being would say. It is a sentence that tries to cram an entire movie's worth of exposition into one sentence The sentence is, Ezekiel Sims, he was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died. So a lot of things that are nuts about this sentence. One, it's so many words, 17 words in one sentence. Two, in a flabbergasting act of just grammatical terrorism, the subject of the sentence changes halfway through. Because first we talk about Ezekiel Sims and he's in the Amazon with the mom. And then it's while she was researching spiders right before she died, like halfway through, we're like, all right, we're changing the subject of the sentence. It's okay. Crazy. And to top it all off, the way that Dakota Johnson reads this completely unhinged line makes it all the more spectacular. I'm going to go ahead and play the trailer for you. We've played it for everybody else the last couple weeks, but you could enjoy this along with everybody else.
Also, is her mom Leighton Meester?
You expect me to know that? Here we go.
Oh, my God.
Sims. He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
Wait, I recognize...
Like, one more time. Give us nothing. You know what I mean?
I've seen that man before.
So who is he?
Ezekiel Sims. He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
I hated that. I really did not like that.
Thanks. I hated it. And one of the things that we pointed out, and also the other thing that makes that line great in the trailer is the stingers that they use. Dum, 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 dum. And it's so unfair to Dakota Johnson. And we were quick to point this out last week.
I don't know.
No, it is because she's a, like, look, I mean, everything I've seen her in, I've never been like, oh, she's a terrible actress. She's a perfectly fine actress. That line is unreadable. And one of the things that we decided last week, Katie, is that there is no actor, living or dead, that we think could read that line well. Like, you could have put that line in, like, Daniel Day-Lewis's hands or Meryl Streep's hands, and they're not going to make that line work. It's just an impossible-to-read line.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Well, I'll tell you... Well, first of all, okay. What actor, living or dead, do you think could possibly read Ezekiel Sims, he was in the Amazon with my mom while she was researching spiders right before she died well? Yeah.
Wait. I'm sorry. Wait. Right before she died, is that the end of the sentence or is there another word after that?
No, that's it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I said the word well at the end because of what I was asking you at the beginning.
Confused me so much because it was literally so many words.
Because there were so many words. That sentence is so long, you forgot the question I was asking at the beginning.
No, and that is my karma. And that's a good point. Now I see it. Now I hear it. I see it. Who could do this well? I don't know. I'll come back to you on that.
Well, but
I think it's just about the way you break it up. Like, you have to make it three sentences, even though it's one. You know what I mean?
Well, that's one theory, right? Okay, the only way to do this is you have to, like, break it up. You have to stretch it out. You need to, like, try to make them separate thoughts. Like, maybe do it like Christopher Walken or something, right? Like,
yeah.
Because he was in the Amazon with my mom. But what we decided last week, Katie, is that that's not the approach you take.
Okay.
If you, like, to read this line well, we decided that the only way to read it well is to accept the fact that it's a terribly written line. And so you just have to get through it as fast as you can. You have to blow through this line. You have to scream it at the top of your lungs and just get through it quickly and then just move on with your movie. Just accept the fact that this line is a disaster and just get through it, rip off the Band-Aid. And in that regard, we realize that there is only one actor, living or dead, capable of reading this line effectively because they can give it the volume and speed that this line deserves. And that actor who's sadly no longer with us, Gilbert Gottfried.
Okay. Okay.
And even though he's no longer with us, the famous comedian, famous for voicing, among other things, the parrot Iago in the Aladdin cartoons. Even though he's no longer with us, what we do have with us is Gilbert Gottfried impersonators. And so we went on to Fiverr.com, Katie, last week, and we paid a Gilbert Gottfried impersonator to read this line from Madam Web for us. And we had a great time last week enjoying it. And so, Lauren, could you play that clip for Katie so she could get in on our joy? On and continue to be obsessed with the completely unhinged line from the Madam Web trailer.
Oh,
Ezekiel Sims. He was in the Amazon with my mom while she was researching spiders right before she died. All in one sentence, like just trying to cram as much exposition as possible into one sentence in a line of dialogue that like no human being would ever utter in the real world. The only actor, living or dead, that we think could read that line and make it work, Gilbert Gottfried. However, what we do have is Fiverr.com to get a Gilbert Gottfried impersonator to read anything you want, including this completely unhinged dialogue from Madam Web. So to test my theory, Lauren, do you have our Gilbert Gottfried impersonator reading this line from Madam Web?
Ezekiel Sims? He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
I mean, Gilbert nails it.
That was something. Wow. Okay. I think you're right. You win. You win. I concede any argument. The more and more I hear the line, the more ridiculous it sounds. And the only way for it to work is to be the most ridiculous delivery of the line possible. And that was it.
Laura, can we hear that audio again? Just the audio this time. Where is any minute now?
Ezekiel Sims? He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died. Ezekiel Sims?
Here twice.
He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
Yeah. No, yeah. Because it really captures like disbelief of like, this guy? He, oh.
Yeah.
My. Whereas, you know, Dakota's delivery is like very factual and emotionless, which like you can't, there's got to be something more going on. And this is giving us like, can you believe this guy? Which I kind of, I can get down with.
You're so right about this, Katie.
I mean,
I've spent so much time defending Dakota Johnson as an actress here, but you're right.
I'm sorry. She's the problem. Like,
only a genius like the late Gilbert Gottfried, who's no longer with us, but this impersonator who is channeling his spirit, would know that this line deserves a high amount of shock.
Yeah.
You have discovered this person.
Yeah.
Who was in the jungle with your mom at the moment she died while she was researching arachnids.
Yeah.
Naturally, you would be shocked by this notion and you'd have to shout this at the top of your lungs. Oh my God, that's the guy who was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
Exactly. And I feel like if Dakota were to deliver it, because like she's not going to yell, she at least needed to be like, I think space it out more of like, that guy, he was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died. But she gave us nothing. So like even my line delivery was better than hers. Let's be honest. And but personally, I prefer this just like outraged, just like aghast version of like, Are you kidding me?
This guy, Ezekiel.
This guy. Not again.
Always in the Amazon with my mom. And the other nice thing about Gilbert Gottfried reading this line is you get to imagine, because like, I don't know how what you see in your mind when you hear Gilbert Gottfried saying that line. But what I hear in my, what I see like imagining is just the bird from Aladdin saying that line.
Yeah.
Like just crackers flying out of Iago's mouth while he is shocked at the sight of Ezekiel Sims being in the Amazon with his mom. In fact, I want to do this for the audience right now. Audience, millennials, I'm talking to you because this is in your film wheelhouse, all right? I want you to hear the Gilbert Gottfried line again, but this time we're all collectively, radio, podcast, live streaming audience, we're all collectively going to close our eyes and imagine the bird from Aladdin saying this. It's going to make us all smile.
Ezekiel Sims, he was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
My favorite part is just with my mom.
We were actually debating that last week of what is funnier, the way he says mom or the way he says died.
I like died, but I almost feel like it's actually not like appalled enough. And with my mom is like really carrying it because it's like,
with like, my mom,
with my mom. Like, and it's like, that's such a good point. He was with your mom. And what is that about? You know what I mean?
It is an important line in the sentence, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Ezekiel Sims, he was in the Amazon. Oh, okay. You know, people go on vacation. The Amazon's a great place to go on vacation.
Who is he with? With my mom.
Oh, like, my God.
Oh, my God. When?
I mean, when was he like, was it just on any one of her expeditions? No, it was on the one right before she died. While she was researching spiders, Katie.
See, and that's why I also was wondering is just in the line structure itself, I feel like those two parts should have been flipped, but it really doesn't work that way either. It's a lot to think
about. You don't
know
how much time I've spent, Katie, like one of those crazed like detectives who got kicked off the force for getting too close to a case, like drawing red bits of string all over my office, trying to find ways to fix that sentence.
I don't think you can. Like, I think that what they should have done is they should have had someone else asking, like, when was this?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like,
Sydney Sweeney should have been doing dialogue with.
Yes, exactly.
Ezekiel Sims. He was in the Amazon with when? Who? With my mom.
With who? When?
When she was researching spiders.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like, what was she doing in the Amazon? Oh, brother.
I don't know if it would have worked for the trailer. Now, okay. Yeah, while we were so busy laughing about this, we completely missed the amazing act of production by producer Lauren here, putting Iago from Aladdin up on the screen. Producer, why don't you get that back up for us? Oh, hello, Iago. All right. So now we can do this again. One last time for the live streaming audience. Keep Iago up there. We're going to play it again. And now we can all really imagine Iago saying this line because the live streaming audience is all looking at the bird from Aladdin right now.
Ezekiel Sims, he was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
I just love the idea of like, wait, what's the villain's name in Aladdin? I'm blanking.
Jafar.
Oh my God, sorry.
I'm going to take your millennial card.
I'm sorry. Like, I just love the idea of Jafar being like, who's this genie guy? What's going on here? And then it's like, oh, that guy?
He was in Agrabah with my monkey while they were getting a magic lamp.
Oh,
my God. That's funny. Okay, see, now this is the problem, Katie, is we've had a lot of fun and we've goofed around, and now we got to do kind of like a powerful, serious topic, and there's no way to transition. This just sucks.
Yeah, maybe we should have swapped topics and done this first, but you know what? I do want to end with this, though.
Yeah.
I want to know from the listeners if, like, your thoughts, and please can you DM me on Instagram at Katie Zagardi, like, are you goofing off with us? Are you laughing with us? Because I want to know your thoughts. I am so curious to hear from the people on this previous topic. And I also want to know if you've seen The Room. And now I also want to hear Gilbert Gottfried quoting The Room. There's just like a lot going on in my mind right now. And I want to know the audience perspective.
Well, we can actually make that last one happen because like the person who did this is a comedian who's at Funny Guy Timmy on Fiverr and on Instagram. You should definitely go check him out because he's been very good to us. Are you saying we need like a recurring segment where we get this guy to read as Gilbert Gottfried a bunch of like lines from terrible movies.
From awful movies. Awful. But also so good.
And if with regard to your first point, Katie, this you actually are bringing up something that I'm genuinely curious about and would like to find a way to poll the audience on this. It's something that I'm always struggling with is I don't know what kind of balance the audience wants in terms of how much goofing around nonsense do they want versus how much kind of like hard hitting advice stuff do they want? Because I know it's not all nonsense, right? Because if it's all nonsense, they could just go to like a comedy podcast.
Yeah.
And I know they don't want all like 100% like important news stuff because you can go get that in other places too. I know people like the mix because they've always told us that, but I don't know like how much we should do. Should it be like 1/3, 2/3, 75, 25? I don't know. And yeah, so to your point, Katie, I would be very interested in the audience's perspective on
that question. Let me know. I want to hear. DM me at Katie Sicardi on Instagram and let's talk about it.
Very good. Daniel Neruda writes in at Break the Business, as long as it's authentically you. Well, don't say that because the authentic me is to do 3 hours on the Madam Web trailer with a quick mention of the story that we're bringing up this week about kid influencers. And I know that's not probably good for what we want to do on this show. But if you want me to be authentic, there we go. So, Katie, I imagine that our podcast had like an award that we gave out each week, which is like the publication that had the coolest, most important news story in the entertainment industry this week.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I were to give this award out most weeks, it would go to the usual suspects, right? I'd be handing it off to Billboard Magazine or Variety or The Hollywood Reporter. Maybe Rolling Stone gets one every once in a while. Maybe The Verge gets one every once in a while if I want a tech story. Hypebot, Digital Music News, all of the usual suspects. But every once in a while, Katie, a more surprising recipient would get this award, including this week. Which, you know, huge upset. All of the usual suspects, I know it's an honor just to be nominated, but they would not win the award this week. Instead, the publication that I think gave us the best article, the most important article in the entertainment industry this week that I do want to talk to you about, Cosmopolitan, if you can believe it. And now this is my own, like, you know, caveman, cisgendered male privilege happening here that... When I saw that this was in Cosmopolitan, my first thought was like, I didn't know Cosmo wrote these kind of articles, right? Like when my own sort of, you know, stupid, stilted male prism here thinks that like, oh, Cosmo is just like sex tips and things like that. And like they are clearly not because they, because journalist, I want to make sure I get her name in here and give her the credit. Journalist Fortessa Latifi wrote a series of articles in Cosmopolitan this week talking about the rise of kidfluencers, kids that are being used by their families in social media posts and influencer campaigns and things like that, talking about not only the rise of this group, but also the dark side of what it means to be a kid influencer and you know, what it can mean for them psychologically, personally, financially, legally. There's a lot to unpack here, and I thought the articles were really powerful. And just to give you a quick intro, so we said that Cosmopolitan talked about the adverse impact that these kid influencers go to when their, quote, sharenter parents post about their kids' lives on social media. Fortessa Latifi chronicles how many influencer parents are facing strong temptations to include their kids in their content, particularly family-related posts or kid-centered posts, because those tend to come with lots of views and often lucrative brand deals. And you know, it's a phenomenon that I have, you know, somewhat familiar with because I have, you know, worked with influencers in the past. I've had kids as clients in the past and have had a range of challenges and difficulties with that. I sent you the article, Katie. I know you were blown away by a lot of what you saw in there.
Yeah, I think it brings up a lot, and there's so much nuance to this conversation. One of the biggest things that I couldn't help but thinking is really just making the comparison to child stars. And I almost feel like in the 90s, I guess there was a lot of kid stars that then ended up sort of going a little cuckoo in the 2000s. And we saw that, and it hasn't happened as much, or at least it hasn't happened as much in the public eye recently, or at least when it does happen, it really does seem to be these kids who were kids in the 90s and who are now getting older. And I just feel like when we look at those people, we're always thinking it's so bad. Their parents forced them into this. Like, you know, it's the same exact thing as what these kidfluencers are being forced to do. But I think that because they're not two things that make it different and worse, in my opinion, because they're not movie stars, it's a lot murkier. Like, who's getting paid? Are they getting paid? Like, at least when a kid is on in a movie or on a TV show, the kid has been hired specifically to do a job on a TV show, and they're probably getting paid, or it's going into like a trust of some sort. That's their money. Now, I know that there are a lot of kid stars, I think like Jeanette McCurdy is one of them, who like had to, you know, they have to support their family. That's not great. But for the kidfluencer aspect of things, the kid's not being hired to do anything. It's not even their account. So who's taking the money? You know, is the child benefiting in any way, or are they simply being exploited? I mean, even if they are making money, would you call that a benefit or an exploitation? That's a conversation to have. The second part of it too is that not only are they, actually, I didn't even finish that point. The point I was going to make was, I think that as the public, in the public eye, we also don't see it as serious or as work because it's social media. So it's a lot harder to distinguish like, oh, this kid that this parent's probably forcing to do videos, but the parent's passing it off as like, oh, I just happened to catch this moment on film. Like, it doesn't look bad necessarily. Yeah. It doesn't look exploitative necessarily, because it's just like, oh yeah, well, I film videos casually when I feel like whipping out my phone and a funny thing happens. So this isn't work. This isn't bad. This isn't whatever. So I feel like it's a lot harder to differentiate. And then the last point to that end, in one of the articles, the person that was giving comment was basically saying like, you know, the relationship with her mom became one, not of like parent and child, but of boss and employee.
Employee. Yeah, that was powerful.
Yeah. And I think that alone is powerful, but especially if we're going to continue to compare it to like kid movie stars, like at least those kids got to go to work and then come home and have a family. Now, I think a lot of their lives at home were not great, which is probably why they were forced into it anyway. But in this situation, there's literally no separation. And I just think how sad that must be to not even have the chance to have any type of normalcy in your family life because your own parents are the ones who are forcing you to do this. So that, I know I just said a lot. There's so much more to say, but it just made me, those were the first things that kind of came to mind reading this. And I think it's really sad when we watch these movie stars, we tend to have conversations about like, this is really sad. They shouldn't be exploited. Like, there needs to be more said around this. And we need to be having the same conversation around social media too.
God, you hit on so many good points there. I'm like furiously taking notes because I want to make sure we touch on a lot of them, because you made a lot of excellent points there. First thing, talking about the really important distinction between like the child stars in film and television and the ones today, right? You talked about the horror stories that film and TV child stars went through in the 90s and, you know, the 70s. We think of like Gary Coleman through the experiences, the horrific experiences that like Jeanette McCurdy, that you mm-hmm. noted, went through.
Yeah.
And because of all those painful things that happened to those people, a lot of laws got developed to protect those film and TV stars.
And there's unions and things like that protect
and there's
them.
There's union protections, there are employment protections. There's requirements that students get a certain amount of education. They, you know, like they bring teachers and schools on set. A whole lot of things to protect kids. On the financial side, we have what are called Coogan laws in most states that actually require that when child stars make money in film and television, a percentage of that income has to be set aside and placed in a trust for that kid when they turn 18 so that their parents can't squander all their money. All of these are really important protections that were brought forth because of all the tragedies that kids came through. And largely, these protections don't exist for kidfluencers. A lot of these laws don't contemplate this kind of work environment where your employer is not some TV studio or film production company, but is your parents at your house with a phone. And the law just hasn't caught up to this yet. Only one state out of 50, Illinois, has any kind of law that protects a child influencer's right to some of their earnings when they turn 18. California tried to pass a law. It wound up, the one that did pass wound up not really having enough teeth to protect this population. But it's a really important situation that the law just hasn't caught up with yet. And God, Katie, the point you brought up there at the end about the distinction between like when child stars work in movies, they get to go home. And their home is like their sanctuary, no matter how tough it was being a child actor. They get to go home to a loving family. When you're a kidfluencer, the crappy environment is at your home. You have nowhere to go. Yeah. You're trapped in it. And it gets to something that like I tell a lot of parents, because I have had, as I said before, I worked with kid clients. I've had child actor, child musician type clients before, YouTubers, things like that. And it's always a scary line because I'm always dealing with parents. And inevitably, the parent wants to take on a dual role where they are their kid's parent, obviously, but they're also taking some kind of role of like being their manager or their lawyer or some kind of role in the organization, usually a manager, like a momager, as they'll call it.
Yeah.
And I will almost always tell the parents, you don't want to be the manager. It is not in your child's best interest to manage your kid. Yeah. And then they'll inevitably say something like, but I want to be involved. I know my kid better than anybody. Why wouldn't I be the best suited person to run to be their manager? And what I always tell them is, you are involved. You have the most important role in your child's life as an entertainer. Parent. You're the parent.
You're the parent. Like, you have to also be able to have objectivity to see.
Yes.
Like, outside of, if I'm negotiating this deal, I might not be able to see if this is best for my kid. But if I can just look at it objectively, it enrages me. Like,
you can't, and it's easy to kind of blast these parents, but I think a lot of them are well-intentioned. But it's still a conflict of interest. You can't be the manager and the parent because those two people have different jobs that often conflict.
Yeah.
The manager's job is to look out for your kid's career. The parent's job is to look out for your kid's best interests. A job that is more important than the first job. And it's a job that you can't do well if your job is also to look out for your kid's career. Your job is to, when the manager pitches things to your kid, it's your job to step in and say, yo, my kid is not going to do that. That is not in my kid's best interest. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
And, that it's something that parents often run into, and it creates a problem for them. And so, like, when I get mixed up in these, it creates an awkward conversation even for me as the lawyer, because one of the first things I have to tell parents when they bring me on as an attorney
is to parent,
but I tell them, look, I need to be, I will take this case, but be clear. I am not your client. I am your child's client. I understand you are the one paying the bills and you're the one paying my legal bills, but your kid is my client. And so I am going to tell you things that, often it's me like looking out for the kid's best interest. And like, I'm often battling the parent because the parent wants to do something for the kid's career. And I'm saying, I don't recommend this. This is not in your kid's best interest. It's almost like I'm becoming the parent. It's often a very awkward situation, but this is the kind of stuff that you get mixed up with when you're involving kids in the entertainment industry that gets multiplied times 1,000 when you're talking about this kind of kidfluencer relationship where you're making content at home and it's happening all the time and there's no distinction between like work and home. And, to this point, and people need to understand this. And I know, Katie, you were touching on this and you're on point with this, is making social media influencer content is a lot harder than it looks. When you see the video on TikTok, it looks like something that somebody slapped together in 30 seconds because it was by design. But in reality, that 30-second video could have taken hours to put together and to plan and to light and to edit afterwards. And it can be incredibly demanding, especially if you're putting out content on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. It's hard to do that and have time to be a kid and to be a family for your child.
Yeah. And I feel like this conversation can, the two big things that I think of are the money part of it, the monetization part of it, and then the exploitative part of it.
Mm-hmm.
I might make a bold claim here by saying that when it comes to the monetization, I honestly think, fine, you as a parent, you get to make the decision as to if you want to create content with your kid. I think if we have time, we might want to go down the road talking a little bit about, is this, should this happen as it is? But let's say they say yes, I think you just should not be allowed to monetize any content with your kid. If you're making content with your kid, you can't be making money. You can't be doing ads on that platform. Again, might be a bold take, but I just don't see how they could possibly regulate social media when, you know, there's no tracking. Like, you, nobody's there tracking the TikTok Creativity Fund and is this money being funneled into a trust for the kid or whatever. Like, nobody's tracking that. And so literally from like a work labor law perspective, I just feel like if you have kids on your channel in that way, you shouldn't be able to monetize. Because I don't, and that's very cut and dry, but I don't know how else they would be able to like regulate that, at least not right now. But then the second part of it is just a conversation about like, should you even be putting your kids on the world wide web in such a broad way? Do we have time to keep this conversation going a little bit, Ryan?
We got about, let's say, 3 or 4. Yeah, we have about 3 to 4 minutes to break down all of the ethical implications of parenting your children in the 21st century. That's enough time, right?
No. Yeah. Okay. I'll go really, really fast. Well, when you sent me these articles, it reminded me of this little girl named Ren Eleanor. And I've been seeing her over my For You page lately. And luckily, I do not see her videos because I don't want to watch them. I don't want to support her channel or her mother because it's really disgusting what she's doing. But I see a lot of people commenting on it. And a lot of people are saying that they think that in a few years, there's going to be a law literally called Ren's Law or something like that, because this mother is creating videos with her daughter. Apparently she has a son too. She's not doing any videos with the son, but she's doing videos with her daughter, who I think is like 4 years old ish. And let's just say they're very suggestive. I think you could watch some of the videos. Like, there's videos of her eating things.
To unsavory audiences.
Yes.
They are. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Say no more. Got it. I'm with you.
Yep. And I know, a sensitive topic, but all of that to say, people are going to her and saying, hey, this is inappropriate. If you look at the comments of the videos, people are treating it inappropriately. They are being gross. They are being disgusting. It is getting into the hands of the wrong people. And not only is she not stopping, but she doesn't seem to care, or she's acting kind of aloof about it, which I think is just a strategy, because she must know what she's doing, and she just continues to do it.
Who knows with these parents?
Who knows? But either way, where's the protection? And, you know, maybe she knows what she's doing, maybe she doesn't know what she's doing, but either way, a certain result is happening, which is it's just getting into the hands of the wrong people. And this poor girl, who has no autonomy, no ability to use the internet or have a say, is being taken advantage of. And she is not the first person for this to have happened to. Unfortunately, I doubt she'll be the last. And I don't really know what the answer is, but I think that that is a huge part of the conversation too, where it's just like, you go down that road and it gets really scary. You know, sometimes it really is just funny videos of kids and you leave it at that, but sometimes it actually is true exploitation and putting kids potentially in danger.
We didn't even get to like the whole notion of just consent, right? That you're literally putting these kids
literally
in these you know, projects without their consent. And yeah. even if like your 5-year-old wants to do it, like they're not of the age of consent to be able yeah. to commit to, you know, agreeing to something like that anyway. They're not old enough to sign a contract. And so that's troubling. Yeah, there's a lot to dig into this topic. We might have to continue this for like another week or something. I don't know. Yeah. Really, really powerful stuff. Let's take a break. We got our guests, Gary Jones and Spira Arkoudis, coming up after the break. Thank you all for checking out Break the Business. We'll be back in 2.
Break the Business is presented in cooperation with Ryan A. Corella, PA. Ryan A. Corella, PA is a law firm providing transactional entertainment legal services, including contracts, business formation, commercial law, copyright, trademark, and more. Ryan A. Corella, PA, Miami, Florida. rkpalaw.com.
Streaming services for Break the Business provided by LEK Entertainment. LEK Entertainment is a full-service entertainment company offering everything from consultations to full-scale events and productions, including audio and video productions, voiceovers, staged theatrical productions, script and music development, and streaming services. For more information, visit lekentertainment.com. LEK Entertainment wants to help you bring your story to life.
Thanks for supporting Break the Business. If you have a question or topic that you want us to discuss, email us at breakthebusiness@gmail.com. You can follow the host, that's me, on Twitter at Ryan KAIR, and you can follow the show at the BTB Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Twitch, YouTube, and Facebook, and on all major podcast platforms. And now, let's get back to the show. Welcome back to Break the Business, everybody. Ryan Corella here, tripping over my words, and that just in case you didn't know if we were live or not. Thank you all for checking us out on all major podcast platforms and all major live streaming platforms and on SiriusXM 145, wherever you're checking us out. Man, we are just so glad that you are. And you'll be soon be able to check us out on volume.com. We're really excited for that. We got some great stuff coming up next month. We're excited to be joining that streaming service. Coming up now is our interview with Gary Jones and Spiro Arkoudis from MetaMusic. We are honored this week to be joined by two executives working on the cutting edge of music as medicine. Our first guest, Gary Jones, is the co-founder and CEO of MediMusic, a platform that generates personalized calming music that can be used by patients to ease pain and stress. Joining Gary is Spiro Arkoudis, the CRO of Tuned Global, a platform that powers the back-end tech for MediMusic and ensures that artists and labels are compensated. Let's find out more together about how this collaboration has flourished and what it means for patient care and mental health. Gary, Spiro, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us, Ryan.
This is really, really interesting. I've always been something of a fan, something of a interested outside observer in this particular phenomenon. I definitely can advocate for, as a layperson, the medical benefits of music and how it has a restorative impact on people. But I'm interested to seeing what role each of you play in this pretty exciting phenomenon. Gary, let me start with you. What does MediMusic do? What's a typical use case for your organization and its products?
Oh, wow. Thanks, Ryan. So that's a good question. I mean, the issue, we're as broad as we are long in terms of the applications of music to health. You can go from dental anxiety, dementia, palliative care, pain. It's immense. And then, you know, our focus is mainly on anxiety and pain reduction. But if you flip our algorithms the other way, you're looking at stroke, you're looking at all sort, physical rehabilitation. You're looking at all sorts of use cases.
That's really impactful. I'm blown away by the broad scope of medicinal applications that music could have to treat a wide range of maladies. Interested in some of what the data says on this. I've read a little bit of data in preparation for this interview, but I'd love to talk to the experts on this. Spiro, let me ask you this question. What is the survey data telling you all right now about how people are already using music to reduce anxiety, improve their health, like Gary mentioned?
Well, we hear from a lot of people, Ryan. So, I mean, you know, the data we look into even comes from rights holders. Give an example, Universal Music Group and so forth, who, you know, we see the benefits that music has in terms of, you know, people's well-being and so forth. So we know it's a valuable form of mental well-being. I mean, personally, I go to music when I'm stressed, right? And we know from a lot of the rights holders too, that's an area they want to, it's also, I guess, a care side of, you know, human nature as well. It's one thing to have music for different reasons, whether we use it to train for fitness and so forth. But I think when it comes, you know, music as medicine, it's critically important, especially if we look at what we just came out of a couple of years ago with COVID, right? And so where did people go to kind of de-stress or, you know, focus elsewhere? Hey, chances are you throw on a, you know, a set of headphones and you listen to music, right, to zone out. So yeah, we know it's important. It's a huge passion point. But I think when it comes to the health of people, music plays a very important part.
And Spiro, you guys are seeing some hard quantifiable data that speaks to the medical benefits of music. This is more than just placebo effect or music makes us feel good. And so if we feel good, we're going to maybe feel better. But like, you're seeing real quantifiable data on this?
We are, basically, and we're also seeing it from universities. So people that are coming to us, I'd say the increase coming from this sector, from universities even in parts of the world, is definitely increasing, you know, and it touches upon points of, you know, and I'll let Gary talk to elements such as dementia and so forth, you know, epilepsy and all sorts of, I guess, illnesses and, you know, elements in human society where music is becoming being used as a medicine form, right? A tool. And so we're seeing it. It's still interesting gathering the actual data to sort of say, where does that actual data exist outside a general survey? But I can tell you, coming from those type of institutions like universities, and yesterday I was speaking to someone in a robotics company who's working with elderly people. And the one thing they're trying to figure out is music. How do they get this music? And it's not just playing music in a background environment, but it's also the cognitive elements it provides is where they're focusing their energy on when it comes to music, right? So I think the data is out there. I think the data, people are looking more into it at the moment. It will come more to hand. But we absolutely seen the increase in appetite for it as well at the moment.
Well, Gary, since Spiro brought it up and mentioned your name, can you talk about some of the more surprising medical benefits that you've seen music have for patients? Maybe some maladies that we might not associate as being something where music could be effective that might impress us?
I'll pull it back a bit. We all self-medicate with music, you know, and when we listen to music, we listen to it as a whole, but the brain actually splits it. So kind of the left side is lyrics, the right side's music. The amygdala deals with emotional response in music. The hippocampus deals with music and memory. The auditory cortex deals with separation of sounds. And if you think about it, one of the things I get all the time or quite frequently, maybe not so much now, is someone turn around to me and say, can really music be dispensed as medicine? And my answer to that is yes. I mean, the science is, there's 25,000 papers on PubMed, there's 40 years of research, that they all prove that the benefits of music to health. We talk about how music can reduce pain, how it can make pain medication more performant and anxiety medication more performant. But the key thing is, if you strip music away from our day-to-day life and think about what we do, rhythm and tempo, key components of music. Without rhythm and tempo, we wouldn't be able to walk. The auditory cortex, I mentioned earlier about how the auditory cortex processes tone and harmony and frequencies and all the kind of things that impact our day-to-day life. We wouldn't be able to sit in a restaurant and have a conversation if it wasn't able to do that. And all those elements that it processes are elements of music. The base, you know, the motor cortex and the base of the brain deal with power in music, and we wouldn't be able to process that without them being there. And our day-to-day life, it's if someone shouts at us or talks quietly to us, that's how we differentiate the difference between a threat and someone being friendly. So I think, you know, one of the things that has surprised me as I've dug deeper and deeper into this, to answer your original question, was how much of the brain is involved in the processing of music. And we still don't know enough. You know, we don't know enough about the brain. We don't know enough about how it's processed in music. And, you know, there's some great books out there that deal with it. Professor Daniel Effenson, the Brain on Music is one of the seminal piece of work, seminal works on it. And, you know, I would recommend anyone to read that if they get the chance.
So Gary's platform, MediMusic, for the viewers and listeners out there, is creating personalized calming music that can be used by patients to ease pain, stress, anxiety, a wide range of medical issues. And Spiro, if I understand it correctly, your role in this project is helping create a lot of the infrastructure for this, and in particular, helping ensure that the artists that are creating music for this platform, or that where the music is being used for this platform, that these folks are getting paid, these folks are getting compensated. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right about that. It is infrastructure, and that infrastructure, let's call it from a music B2B perspective, you know, is a content delivery platform. So how do you get the music to the platform, right? That's one thing. And the other side of that is obviously if you're doing so, to be able to report them back on that to rights holders. There's various APIs that are consumed by a lot of our clients. So we provide a lot of the listening functions that are then used by services such as MIDI Music. So we have relationship, obviously, with the rights holders themselves. You reference the artist, so that usually means relationship with the record labels. You've got to be cognizant of the relationship with publishers and so forth. So we bring a whole gamut of not only the technical infrastructure, but also understanding the rights holder side, which is obviously a critical part of this business. And we obviously work very closely with Gary in terms of the rights holders as well. So infrastructure, but also managing the rights side, which can be complicated for the uninitiated.
And for the initiated too, as I was thinking, there was nothing easy about dealing with music rights holders. And I was impressed, and you know, I'll just say it, shocked to learn that the three major record labels are working with you all on this, that you have partnerships with them. I mean, you want to talk about the challenges of rights management, dealing with that particular three-headed beast is no easy task. Gary, can you give us a little bit of the backstory about how the three major labels got involved with your project? Are they fans of the idea of music as medicine as well?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, we've all self-medicated music. I said previously, if you look at the great thinkers of our time, Confucius, Plato, Tolstoy, Einstein even wrote a book about it, Martin Luther King, they've all extolled the benefits of music to health. So it's nothing new. And you know, the rights holders are looking for other revenue streams. I think COVID has probably helped with this in some ways, in terms of an awareness of more of music and its benefits to our health and dementia. Certainly some of the recent, you know, publicity globally about music and its influence upon those that have been diagnosed with dementia and how it helps people remember. And it's been around 40 years. I mean, I think the two kind of, I guess, cornerstones for why it's now become such a popular topic is the advent of digital music or digitization of music and algorithms. So we can actually start to train algorithms to think, you know, to kind of mimic the human brain's response to a degree to music to produce this kind of effect that we're looking for in terms of reducing heart rate and increasing heart rate variability. But, you know, it's been around for a while. And I think the labels for us have been brilliant. Universal, Sony, Warner's have all been fantastic. They've all embraced us, opened their arms. They've not made it too painful at all, really. And it's, you know, we're here, you know, the labels and us are really the middlemen. It's about the artists. And it's also about the people that we're helping to feel some benefit from the artist's music.
Wow, that is an exciting prospect. And it's cool to see the three major labels seeing the value in this and being such faithful partners for you all. I'm going to ask a question to each of you here, because I like to get double the perspective when I think is a very important subject area. So I'll start with you, Spiro. Tell me what your expectations are for the future of this field, music as medicine. What does your collaboration, what does the science, what does the business aspects of all of this look like 5 to 10 years from now?
I think we will see this. I mean, from my perspective, I think, you know, from what Gary's doing and in the future of other companies, you know, I expect to see, you know, in a perfect world, you know, hospitals, there'll be software solutions, there will be interfaces within, you know, medical, all sorts of different backgrounds where music, commercial music will be consumed. But I think importantly, music will be used as medicine, right? I think at the moment, Gary's doing, a couple of others are spearheading in this industry, will allow others to follow on. So I think we're going to see a flurry of new players in the future, but I think at a much probably more macro level as well, right? When people understand the benefits, and there is a pathway here. I think the challenge here, Ryan and Gary, you might've seen in the early days is how do you get from A to B in this space, right? From one thing, having an algorithm and having an ID, crossing that whole, you know, bridge of music rights, complexities of licensing and how that all works. And I think, you know, in 5 years time, and Gary called that out, the labels have been great. I mean, the majors are really trying. They're curious. They want to know more. How can they support? So I think we're laying the foundation, Ryan and Gary, for the future. Here we will see a lot more plays in this space, and we're going to see probably more of the quantifiable data that we all kind of keep looking for, you know, from probably bigger institutions as well. So I think the future will involve music being consumed at a much more deeper level across medical institutions and so forth, right? And I think Gary and what Gary's doing, a couple of the other players are kind of spearheading that. And you're seeing the stories in the press. I'm seeing him in music press more and more now. Yeah. You know, Universal's Health Summit a couple of weeks ago in I think it was a couple of months ago in LA. So more and more of the rights holders want to play their part in this as well.
Gosh, that's an exciting prospect, both for the patients and just the regular folks out there who are going to benefit from the medicinal properties of music, but also what it means for rights holders and artists as well. Gary, let me ask you that same question. Where do you see the field in 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, no, man, I completely agree with Spiro. I mean, Spiro and I have been, God bless him, right from the start, he's been on this journey with me. When I phoned him up with a wacky idea one day, and him and Colin, and they stuck with me and seen it through, and I'm wholly appreciative of that. But I was at Lucian Grainger's conference, the Lucian Grainger's conference in LA that Spiro's just alluded to in the summer. And, you know, they are adamant that this is going to be a major, major source of revenue for them, and a major route for listening to new music and existing music and old music. And I think in my, you know, I often feel like many music is a crash test dummy for the rest, you know, for the future. We're kind of some of the things that we're doing, nobody's ever done before. We're all about efficacy and ongoing efficacy and trials. And you know, we go into a trial situation, and we're doing the same kind of documentation, going through the same process that Big Pharma goes through, yet we're a therapeutic. So, you know, you've got a 468 page ethics form with 20 company documents. That's what a big pharmaceutical company does. That shouldn't exist. So I think some of the things we're doing now will hopefully change that. There are organizations like the Digital Therapeutics Alliance in the US that are helping to kind of change that mindset. There's some stuff going on in the UK as well. But I think, you know, it's got to be for the future. You know, the labels are going to make this simpler in terms of the rights management, the NHS, the healthcare systems have got to adopt it. And, you know, music therapy has been around a while. But I think in 5 to 10 years time, we or as many musical, someone or a group of us will be dispensing music as medicine, because we will have built the clinical data or taken the existing data and used it and added on top of that our own data to create an undeniable solution that people can benefit from.
Well, certainly no easy task trying to affect change either in governments or in the three major record labels. And so I commend both of you for going on that journey and finding the excellent partnerships that you've had along the way. Before we go to our final question, let me just ask you real quick, Gary, where can our viewers and listeners go if they want to learn more about all this?
So if they want to know more about MediMusic, please go to www.medimusic.co, not .com or .co.uk, but .co. Get in touch, reach out. I'm on LinkedIn. You'll find us on LinkedIn. If you've got any questions, just please ping me a mail. I try to answer everything that comes in related to us, any questions we get. I mean, I could probably get 20 or 30 emails a day from people asking questions, but I'm always happy to answer them when I've got time. And bear with me, I will get back to you.
All right, Spiro, let's start with you on the final question. And as you're answering that question, of course, you're welcome to let us know where we can find out more about your company as well, Tune Global. But last question for you, Spiro. Do you have any last tips for the indie creators out there to help them move their careers forward?
I think be curious. Continue to be curious. Ask questions. Research, right? Build networks. I think it's really important to build networks in this industry, right? Read, follow blogs, you know, and if you see, contact people. I mean, I'm a firm believer. I am a sales guy, but I contact people. I'm curious. If I see someone talking about a subject matter I think's important to me, I'll try and connect to that person, go find them on LinkedIn. Don't be shy. Ask questions. Ask as many questions as possible and build a strong network. I just find, you know, one way to kind of get ahead and understand, you've got to build a really good support base and network around you. So build your networks. You know, ask the questions. You know, there are no dumb questions, right? And that's how you kind of build, I guess, your wealth, your knowledge system, and grind away. Don't give in. Always chip away.
Let's get more good advice. Two pieces of good advice for the price of one. Over to you, Gary. Take us home. Same question. Any last tips for the indie creators out there?
Well, not surprisingly, I agree with Spiro, but I mean, I'll add to that. Always be refining, kind of picking at what you're doing, trying to make it simpler and simpler and simpler so it's easier for people to understand. And never say no. You know, you never know. Someone contacts you and said, hey, I want to chat. I want to talk about something. I'm really interested to hear what you have to say. Always speak to people because, you know, at the end of the day, you never know where that's going to lead to. It's networking again you might look at someone and think, actually, you know, what are you bringing to the table? But always have that conversation. And I agree with Spiro, networking's key, absolutely key. And pick up the phone or use email, speak to people, contact people. All they can do is turn around and say, no, I'm not interested. And it costs you nothing.
I love that piece of advice. Music as medicine is such an endlessly fascinating subject area that I feel like we've only scratched the surface on this discussion. And so I hope maybe we can bring you all back again sometime to talk even more about it. In the meantime, though, I appreciate you both coming on, and I thank you both so much for your insight this week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Gary Jones and Spiro Arcudis, everybody. Really terrific conversation. Really important topic. I definitely meant it when I said we want to have those folks back on real soon. Our thanks to Gary and Spiro. Our thanks to Katie Zaccardi and producer Lauren for joining us. We've had a blast. And of course, thanks to all of you viewers and listeners for checking out Break the Business. We'll see you next week.